Psalm 139. You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You're familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you're there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All of the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you. If only you, God, would slay the wicked. Away from me, you who are bloodthirsty. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, Lord, and abhor those who are in rebellion against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Search me, God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I really enjoy coming to the evening service, not least because I find when we sing, it sounds like there's like 500 people in here rather than the 20 odd there are. So it's fantastic. It's not just Nathan, I don't think, either. I blame on the Holy Spirit more than anything else. So today I'll be looking at Psalm 139, particularly looking at verse 14. I think I've preached a couple of times now at Christchurch Dunstan, and every time in the past I've done it, Charlie sort of gave me the verse and said, you know, crack on, Ben, and that's been fine. This time, as you know, we're going through sort of our favourite verses, and actually, you know, to be honest, I don't think a favourite verse as such. I've always marvelled at people who do and, you know, demonstrate their knowledge of the Bible. I think, so for me, I didn't really have one. So what I've done is I've sort of looked back on my last few years, I suppose, and thought about a passage that really helped me. And that's what I've come to. So verse 14 is the bit I'll be particularly looking at today, and it's, I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. And I suppose the period of my life I'm looking back to for then is the birth of my children. So I'm sure you all know who they are, George and Jemima. They're not quiet members of our church congregation, I don't think. And it's the memories of those newborn tiny children are still really fresh to my memory, despite all the lack of sleep. I suppose it's sort of that period of my life where I'll be drawing on from today. Indulge me, you know, as a father, obviously the first thing I want to do is talk about my kids. Please indulge me with that. But to reassure you, these verses and this sort of sermon isn't exclusively aimed at fathers of newborn children. Hopefully there's something in there for everyone. And really, I'm trying to draw out today the incredible value that these passages show us that we have in the eyes of God, no matter where we are in our own sort of journey. So I still remember quite vividly coming home, and particularly with George, I think, night one. Joe had just gone to bed, well, night two, you know, Joe had just gone to bed after coming home from hospital, and I would think I was alone with George, probably for the first time. And I read him Genesis 1, verse 27, which is, so God created mankind in his own image, in the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. And that was a really awesome moment. You know, it was seeing God's word brought really vividly to life. You know, literally, out of nothing, George and then Jemima had been born and was now a living thing with a life ahead of him that only God knew, that only God had made. He was brand new to me, but the idea he was well known and created by God was immense and like spine tingling, you know, feeling, you know, and we'll come on to this word again, but you know, this idea of it was almost like fearful. It was awesome and a rare feeling. And I toyed with using that verse today. But actually I've chosen a linked verse. So verse 14 of, you know, this amazing psalm. When we were first parents, we were given a print of the verse and it stuck up on our walls and it's still there now. And it was this verse more than any other, which I think really sustained me throughout those first few months and now to this day. And why? Well, this verse, this whole psalm, I think brings Genesis, that story of creation, the facts, if you like, to life. It elevates and expands on those Genesis verses, those couple of sentences, to help us see the relationship filled with love and care that was created in this, in God's creation of us. To know God, to know that God made you is one thing. To see the extent of his knowledge, his care, his love for us in this poetry, in this psalm, I think is another. And so in my sleep-deprived, anxious, confused, joyful, worried, name an emotion, you feel it back then, this verse, it was this verse more than any others that served as the perfect reminder of how awesome this little bundle was and what a privilege it was to be entrusted with something so valuable in God's eyes. And it really kept me and keeps me going as, you know, as I try to be a sort of a godly father. So this verse sits in the middle of the psalm, which can be roughly split into four parts. And for any of you who's read the Christopher Ash book, that goes through a bunch of different psalms, I did actually also come up with those four sections before reading that book, but Christopher Ash did the same, so we're on the same page there. I think the context of the verse in the wider psalm, I think, really brings out the power of the verses further. So we'll look at each of those four sections really briefly, before returning to the verse a bit more, and then we'll end on what our response to these truths might be. And what I thought might be nice is a bit of audience participation, and it actually also was Charlie's idea. So what I thought we'd do, we break the four verses down. If someone, if you know, in the crowd doesn't mind reading, you know, the passage in its chunk. So part one, which is sort of headlined knowledge, or I've headlined knowledge, is verses 1 to 6. So would someone mind reading that out for me? I'll pick on you if no one puts their hand up fast. Charlie, good man. I've seen James can do it next, and Matt can do third. Go on, Charlie.
Psalm 139 for the director of music of David, a psalm. You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain.
Thanks very much, Charlie. So I think, you know, this passage, I think, really just serves to demonstrate his sheer and utter knowledge of us. And each of us as an individual, not as a sort of, you know, conglomerate humanity. I think it's really probing at sort of our, you know, the personal knowledge of us, to the point where he knows us better than we can even know ourselves. So, you know, you have this idea of, you know, he's searching. God is searching to know us. God hasn't just watched from afar, although he does know our thoughts from afar. He has actually come into contact to develop real knowledge of us. And it means he knows everything there is to know about us, our actions, our thoughts, when we wake, what we do, you know, when we wake and sleep and all our habits in between. And he knows our words before we do. And I think this is a real testament to how much he knows us. We are all largely defined by what we do say as much as what we don't say. I think the way we speak and the words we use is the gateway to our being, to our soul. You know, if we choose to say something mean, that says something about us. Conversely, if we choose not to say something mean, then that says something else about us. Our words, what we do and what we don't say, reveal who we are and God knows them before we say them, and which I think really reveals the extent of his knowledge for us, his personal knowledge for us. And then verse 5, just to finish that off, it talks about hemming me in behind and before, you know, laying your hand upon me. And I think for me that created this image of an all-encompassing knowledge. He is around and on us. He truly knows us, you know, to the point where in verse 6, you know, David is saying, such knowledge is too lofty for me to attain. God knows us better than we do. So that's part one, knowledge. Part two, presence. James 7 to 12, please.
When do I go from your spirit? When do I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me, and the light will become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day. The darkness is our light.
So, thank you, James. So, you know, really simply, presence. Verse 7 asks, where can I go from your spirit? And the answer, you know, to cut it short, nowhere. Wherever we go, he will be there. And that is in the physical sense. So the verses talk of, you know, height, depth, to the very end of the world, God will be there. And not just passively. You know, verse 10 talks of, an active presence. Even there, your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. Holding, guiding, these are active, caring words. But then, you know, even moving away from the physical sense, he is present in other senses too. In verses 11 and 12, you know, with this utter darkness that is described, you know, for me, it was this sense of a spiritual attack, perhaps, or, you know, a real despair, depression of the mind. That will not deter God from us. For him, there is no darkness. So come what may, we can absolutely rely on God to not leave our side. So that's presence. Part three is creation. And Matt, I think I saw your hand go up. Verses 13 to 18, please.
You created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you.
Thanks, Matt. So I think this creation section, I think hammers home Genesis, hammers home the, you know, the creation story in Genesis. And I think hammer is a rubbish word in this context, as this is, I think, you know, it's joyful poetry describing in beautiful detail what happened in that Genesis sentence where God created mankind. Our physical coming together is described as knitting in verse 13, woven in 15. In my mind, it brings forth images of a caring assembly with care given to each strand, each fibre. And he isn't just creating our physical being, our physical presence, our bodies. He is creating our entire lives. Verse 16 says, all the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. It's worth pausing here, I think. I am so challenged by that verse. Do I believe that? Do I really believe an all-powerful, deeply loving God is in complete control of my entire life before I even started it? It is, I think, almost too good to be true, and I think that's often why I struggle really believing, I suppose. But it is true, and, you know, we should reflect on that lots to help it sink in, and it is something to really encourage us and steady us through all of life's ups and downs. And part four is our response. So, and that sort of takes us up to the from verse 19 onwards. Does someone like to read that? I didn't catch a final hand. Susan, I see you've read it already, so you might as well finish it off for us.
If only you, God, must slay the wicked. Away from me, you who are bloodthirsty. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, Lord, and abhor those who are in rebellion against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Search me, God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting.
Thanks, Susan. So I think this I found when I read it before, and even in the way, you know, Susan read it so well, I think it's this passage is sort of, it's rather graphic. It's jarring to the preceding verses. It is in strong contrast to the flow and the love that, you know, comes out of the preceding verses. And I think actually it might not sit well with us. And at first glance, they were tricky verses I found to explain and sort of had to sort of work through them with Charlie in preparation for this talk. But I think I'd be keen to sort of, I suppose, note a couple of details, I suppose, I think help us sort of picture this, you know, in a biblical way. So first, the author, David, is asking that it is God who slays the wicked, not him. He, David, is not acting as either the judge or the executioner. He is asking God to conduct his justice. David is not asking to do this himself. So I think that's an important point to note. And then what is David doing himself? He is just staying well clear of those who are actively against God, those who are bloodthirsty, who speak of God with evil intent. David describes his hatred, his horror at these people actively against God, but does not claim to seek to kill them in this psalm. And let's also remember that David, the author of this psalm, like many others, like many other psalms, I should say, he was a covenant king of a covenant God. It wasn't just anyone. And let's also remember who came after David, who would have also sung these psalms, Jesus. Their exalted positions for the people of God mean that they can speak these words with a certain authority. And Jesus in particular can speak these words with perfect purity, without any malice, any personal hate, any personal vengeance. Now, we cannot claim either of these things. So what's the key takeaway for us in this passage, in this part four, our response? So I think I spent quite a long time trying to figure it out, I suppose. I think by being the creation of an omniscient, omnipresent, deeply caring God, we are on his side and therefore against evil. And how should we show this? How does that manifest? Well, we should be, like David, asking God for justice in this world. But it's God's perfect justice we are asking for. We are not taking things into our own hands. And what else should we be doing? We should be running away from sin, and we should be hating it. We need to take it really seriously, be horrified, and run. Now, you know, you come to this verse, we must always remember all the other parts of the Bible that talks about how we must love our neighbour, forgive and forgive and forgive, and never forget that it is the sinner who Jesus came for. History is peppered with strong opponents of God coming to Jesus. So we need to read these verses in that context, but these verses must remind us of how serious we must be against the sin that we see around us. And you know, it's interesting that the author, even David, has focused on sin out with him before coming into the sin internally, because that is just, the temptation that I think we probably all have, focusing on the sin of others rather than focusing on the sin of us, ourselves. But David does. He does return to the sin in himself. Look in 23, in, you know, verses 23 and 24. We should be really concerned about our own sin just as much, you know, if not more, than the sin of others. David, Jesus even, is testing himself for any blemish, any offensive way, and acting to root it out, asking God for help to lead him in the way everlasting. And that's what we too should be doing. We should be asking God to be searching us further. He's already said the author's already said that God has been searching us, and you know, he's made us. But you know, David is asking, Jesus is asking to come again, search us again, beyond the knowledge of us already, so that we can have nothing to hide, and so he can be helping us, truly helping us, in the way everlasting. That's a good prayer to pray. So that's sort of the psalm overview, and we'll come back now to verse 14, and sort of the first half, if you like. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Nicely in the middle of the psalm. I think it, for me, it's not a summation necessarily, but it's like you've squeezed all the goodness out of this psalm, and it's dropped, you know, it's distilled this lovely little drop of a verse. And it brings this psalm together, I think, and it's some, you know, it's about that every person was uniquely made by God. And we'll break it now into two. So first, the slightly easier bit, I suppose, the wonderful bit. Our creation was a wonderful event. Your specific creation was a wonderful event. And that imparts serious inherent worth on us all. And we should definitely tell each other that more often. And not as a personal boast, but in a boast about our Creator God. Just, you know, you can look at the whole Bible, but look at the psalm alone. A perfect God was personally involved in your personal creation. An all-loving God has intimate knowledge of your entire being in thought, action, words. An all-powerful God is with us no matter where we go and will help us in the way everlasting. Genesis states that we are made in God's image. It's these verses, I think, that give us further insight into what that really means. Of course our creation was wonderful. Of course we're wonderful. How could we be anything but, with what God describes in this psalm? And let's not forget, our wonderfulness is for eternity. By trusting in Jesus' sacrifice on the cross, we are destined for eternity in paradise with God. How wonderful indeed. The fearful word in this verse is one I've grappled with a bit over the week or so. And I was initially drawn to it, you know, in a simple way of it meaning that we are made to fear our God, which is right. We are to fear our God. But I think this specific verse is more than that. It's that the very act of our creation was fearful. And fearful is potentially, a tricky word, I think, in this context. This fear is not a scared fear. It's a righteous fear, or like a sacred fear. Sort of, you know, going back to that, you know, that feeling I had with George, I think, and Jemima when they were first born. A couple of Bible translations have it as awesome instead of fear. And I think it's that, you know, as I say, that weird feeling that you might occasionally get when you behold something like, you know, really, really big, really, really awesome. Behold, like, great power. I think of the feeling, you know, as well as that time with George and Jemima, of like, you know, that feeling stereotypically of when you look up at the stars and think of the power that must have made them, that created them. Or when the beauty of the situation just takes your breath away. I think that's the sort of fearful word. That's the sort of use of the word fearful here. And I think you know, what does that mean for us now? And again, something I've really grappled with, I suppose. But it's that, I think it means that our creation, and I mean our personal creation, your creation, was actually, it's a big deal. It wasn't a mistake. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't a simple thing that was done easily or without any care. It wasn't something that anyone can do, anyone can hack together. These words demonstrate that we are unique, we are complex and awesome in the sight of God, the creator of all things. I think that's hard to comprehend, I think, so let that sink in. I think I was trying to think of a way of how to describe it. So I think there's like the opposite I can think of, which I think hopefully will help. So I think, I work in, I won't use my personal experience, but lots of people work in big organisations, and every now and then they'll get like that email, or they'll sit in a big audience where a senior person comes up and says, you know, good job, you've done amazing things this year, really proud of you, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you sit there, you might sit there and think, well, you know, that person doesn't have a clue who I am or what my output is or what I've done. And he's saying these as like platitudes. They don't really, they got to say them, but they don't really mean anything. Don't be tempted to think that about God. God is saying this not because as a general thing. He's not saying you are fearfully and wonderfully made in general. He's saying you are wonderfully and fearfully made. It's God who knows each and everyone deeply. He is with you constantly wherever you are. He made you in your mother's womb. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. We are of great worth to our God. So I think, you know, I could double the time of this talk by now talking about responses. I won't, although there are 3 clocks in this room and none of them work, so you would have no idea. So I've just chosen 3 responses and just before we finish, and they sort of allude back to my time, I suppose, with George and Jemima. But will be applicable to, hopefully, I hope, will be applicable to everyone, regardless of their situation. And I'm going to try and do 3 R's, Charlie. You'll be proud. And my first response is reassurance. So an overriding feeling back then, back with George, back with Jemima, it was a simple emotion, and it was just pure fear. It was pure terror. I looked at my son, my daughter, and I simply wanted the best for them, but they were so small and so vulnerable. There was so much that could happen to them that I just had, you know, no control over. There was so much to worry and be anxious about. And, you know, that's not a parent-exclusive feeling, I know. And, you know, we don't have to be parents to care and hope for others and have this feeling. But knowing that God had made George and made Jemima, knowing that he knew them better than they would know themselves, that I would ever know them, and that he was to be with them always and had created their entire life, was just an immensely great comfort. And it, you know, it was then and it is now. And I, you know, to the point where I don't really know how non-Christian parents manage, how they get out and how they go. You know, really put as simple as possible, God has got those you love the most. You know, and it's not to say that all things will go perfectly for us, you know, not in a worldly sense. Jesus himself asks us to carry the cross to serve him. But, you know, it's written in Romans, we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him. And we are wonderfully and fearfully made by an all-powerful, all-loving God. If I believe that, then I can be sure that come what may, it is God's plan. It was God's plan for their good. It's God's plan for our good. My second R response is to respect. George and Jemima were fearfully and wonderfully made. Now, there were times when this verse was really easy to say and accept, when you were holding them and they were asleep most of the time, looking adorable. But actually, there were lots of other times where it was really hard to say that, and that's when the verse was more helpful. How much did I need reminding of this when George was, or Jemima was crying again at 3 a.m. and all I wanted to do was sleep? Or, you know, more recently, the tantrum starts and it's 45 minutes of a complete meltdown because he's got the wrong spoon. Or when he disobeys again and again and again. Now, I'll be honest, there were times, lots of times really, when I was genuinely angry at this poor, defenseless, you know, newborn baby who I love dearly. And it was this verse in particular that reminded me of the value that God had put on him, on her, on them, and helped me see just how special they were, no matter what the circumstances were. And these verses apply to, you know, to try and broaden the scope of this, they apply to everyone. They apply to you, they apply to you, they apply to you. And I need to ensure I apply these verses in my relationships with others, but also myself. Do I respect those in the street as if they have been fearfully and wonderfully made by God? My enemies? Worse, do I treat myself like that? Each of us have an intrinsic value to an all-powerful, all-loving God. No one else matters at the end of that. So let's act like it. And finally, and I'll be honest, Charlie, I struggled with this. I've got real gratefulness, because it was just gratefulness. And this is the last point. We sometimes may think the idea of God sacrificing his own son would have been too much of a cost to save someone like me. Why on earth would he do such a thing? Why would he send his only son to save us in all my sin? Little old me? But we were fearfully and wonderfully made by God. That's what it says, and it's backed up by so much of the Bible. God really loves us. He really cares for us. And in that love, he is going to give us much more than we deserve. He is going to sacrifice his own son to bring us back into a loving relationship with him. And looking at my son and my daughter on those first few hours of their lives, I was simply so, so grateful of this love, of the sacrifice that God had made, and of the future eternal hope that they could have. So why don't we end, I'll end with a prayer, and then why don't you turn to your person next to you and tell them that you are wonderfully and fearfully made. Dear God, thank you for these encouraging verses. We pray that we may truly believe it, that no matter what our circumstances, no matter what our relationships we have with others, that we will reflect on these verses, that we will believe in them, and that we will act them out, Lord, both for ourselves and for those around us. Amen.